Yak the Culture to everyone out there listening, and welcome to another episode of Macross Speaker Podcast, the only dedicated podcast out there for that wonderful show we all love, Superdimensional Fortress Macross, which is all about, you know, idols and transforming planes and overly expensive toys. And
so much excitement that we're feeling right now.
The power of culture. And speaking of culture, to my far right, who have I got?
Renata. Rivera Ruska. There you go.
And to my other right, I've got...
Adrian. Forum user saved. It's never on the forums anymore.
That's true, actually. You have been kind of absent from the forums.
Not because I don't enjoy it. I still love all my fellow forum members, even the ones that take time to bitch about it.
Alright, so...
Is this mic picking up the helicopter that we're being ambushed by right now?
Isn't that the same helicopter that was in Macross Zero that Satellite's been, like, reusing every production, wasn't it?
I can see the UN Spacey logo from here.
It's like they're filming the Pat Labor really bad live-action movie outside. So this is the... what was it? Mr. K, Emergency Damage Control episode of the Macross Speaker Podcast. Because recently there was a blog post put up by Mr. K of Arcadia about the process of making their very expensive Valkyrie toys.
Are they expensive, though?
Well, we're going to get to that. But first, I'd like to step back a bit and talk about an event we went to recently. Guys.
A gathering. It was not an event.
That's okay. A fan gathering?
Gathering, or an off-kai, as they're called.
An off-kai. Shall we explain off-kais? Because that's something I don't think...
You would know what off-kai is.
I do know what it is, but I haven't been to enough to really properly explain them.
Well, off-kai stands for offline.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, that's what
it is. I didn't even know that.
So they started, I'm presuming, like the early 2000s, from what I've heard.
And I thought you meant it was just unofficial kind of thing.
No, I asked a couple people because I didn't know either. And that's what they told me. And the Kai, of course, is meeting or gathering.
Yeah.
And so it's
not VF19 Kai then.
No.
Unfortunately.
So it's a gathering of fans in real life. It's an RL meeting.
This is just going on a tiny, tiny tangent. I once read a post in Macross World that said, "I love Kai. He's my favorite character in all of Macross. His bright red Valkyrie that shoots speaker pods is really cool. Kai is my favorite character."
Well, it's about as good as that review of Macross Frontier on YouTube where they're like, "My favorite character was Skull Leader."
Foy fucker.
Alright, I might as well throw this in there.
All right.
While I was away in California on the last day when I was on the day of my flight, I went to another kind of off-kai. It's an unofficial Lego event called Brickfest, where people go and they sell all their Legos and people make customs.
Okay.
And I got photos on my phone. I'll have to show you guys. Wherever my phone might... Oh, it's charging.
Cool.
So, in the custom area, somebody did a 1J armored.
Oh.
A Max and Miria with fast packs and a 1S in fighter mode. And they're all fully transformable.
Really?
Yeah. They're really nice. I'll go get them. And they even made a diorama with, like, Lego buildings and stuff.
Wow.
And the funny thing was, is, like, Brickfest is for, like, family and little kids building in Legos. And everyone that walked up to the table that was a little kid just constantly kept saying, "Transformers! Transformers! That's a Transformer! That's a Transformer!" And then the other half walked up and said, would go to get to the... 1J in armor mode, and go, "Optimus Prime! It's Optimus Prime!"
The 1J?
Yeah.
In armor.
Yeah.
I guess
because it's all blue and red.
Two antennae, maybe.
But it's made of Lego, so it's bulky, right?
Yeah.
And these kids are like between the ages of like 5 and 11. I can just see like wanting to strangle these kids.
I think it's kind of charming. I thought
it was interesting, but it was a lot.
Kids.
But after thinking about it, I was like, it's so much better than any one of them saying, "Hey, that's a Veritech."
So you didn't hear the word Veritech the whole time?
I didn't.
What were they being displayed as?
It was just this big rectangle table of everyone putting all their own custom Legos up. That's Optimus Prime.
Oh, well, that's nice.
It could be Optimus Prime. About this big. I mean, who knows what Optimus Prime looks like these days.
The missiles and everything.
Yeah.
That looks cool. That's a strike pack.
Yep.
Wow.
So we'll have to...
So this transforms.
I think they do. Like, look at the detail on the back. So, I'm pretty sure that's transformable.
It looks... Yeah.
Damn.
Wow.
Anyways, okay, enough of the tangent.
No problem. So, we went to this Off-Kai, this fan gathering. And it was on July 19, and it was this tiny cafe called Cafe One Point. Now, Adrian and I got there first. You came in well towards the second half, Renato. And,
well, I had to work.
Yeah. But it was a tiny gathering.
Actually, I wasn't even invited.
I got you in.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, everyone knew you were working.
Oh, really?
It was a tiny gathering, invitation only. I would say there'd be 20 people. Does that sound like too many?
Yeah, something like that.
So you had like one table in the middle, two or three on the outside, and that was it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was
really tiny. Packed.
It was
because the place was
full
small.
House. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was organized by the Macross Worldcon 2014 cosplay contest winner, who, and friend of the podcast, we've mentioned many times before, Hisame, who, while better known for her Basara cosplay, was present at this event dressed as Hibiki, complete with that hair.
Hibiki Kanzaki.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, is there any other Hibikis in Macross?
No.
There are also a bunch of other fans there, well, a handful of other fans who were also in cosplay. Even though it wasn't a cosplay kind of event, but we had a Sylvie, who was a really pretty good Sylvie, actually. We had an Ishtar, and we had a second Hibiki who was in a white suit based on an art card that was released for Macross the Museum. So it was a really modern interpretation of Hibiki.
It's funny, because I walked in, and there's all these people in cosplay, and one white guy who looked like he was wearing a white tuxedo, and I'm like, who's that guy supposed to be?
It was
Hibiki in the white suit, but like...
But have you seen the art card that was based on?
I have, but even if... But I mean, I didn't put the two and two together.
Okay. So it wasn't, as I said, a cosplay event.
But you should describe what kind of Ishtar costume, because she wasn't wearing the Miko dress, right?
She was supposed to be in the wedding. She was doing the same outfit as the Hibiki.
The Hibiki.
It was supposed to be a white wedding dress, or whatever she was wearing. A bridesmaid's dress.
So for people who haven't seen them, there were two art cards. One for the guys and one for the girls. And it's all the girls dressed up in kind of wedding gear and wedding dresses, and all the guys in suave white tuxedos.
Yeah. And that girl there in the corner, I had a conversation with her about, girls wanting to do the most recognizable Ishtar dress, which is nothing, almost.
Okay.
Right? And she was saying, yeah, nobody really has the courage to do that. We want to do it, but we can't. No.
Well, let's take a step back. And what was this event? Gathering. What was this gathering? It was a fan gathering. It had no official endorsement as such, which is why you correctly said, Adrian, it's not really an event. Despite having no official endorsement, there was a special guest, which was Tsutomu Takayama, the Japanese voice actor for Hibiki. And who has since Hibiki done practically no other voice roles of any note whatsoever. He doesn't seem to be all that active in the voice acting community anymore. Now, the bulk of the event... So he was there. We went for four hours. And the main bulk of the event was a screening of something, which went for a combined total of 3 hours. I won't say exactly what was screened because they didn't have official permission to screen it, and we were told not to blog about what we were watching. However,
let's just say it was more like a group riff tracking and a commentary.
Yeah, we had the voice actor for Hibiki doing a commentary, live commentary of something for 3 hours, so I don't think that's too hard to piece together.
And we were throwing in jokes here and there. Like, people would make comments, laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't he do this?
Yeah.
Why are they wearing this and missing this or something? Pointing out, like, you know, errors in the animation.
Mm-hmm.
Animation? I thought we were talking about Robin Holiday.
There you go.
Yeah, well done. Well done, Runo. Well done.
Thank you.
You get the Goobaba Award for this podcast. So, there are a lot of tidbits that he dropped during this commentary. How much of it did you see, Renato?
I think I just arrived just before the final episode.
The final part.
I mean, the final part of
something.
Yeah. Just Audrey Hepburn is, telling the truth. Whoa, what's going on? Oh my god! The TV is gonna take over and murder us.
The Roku has suddenly activated. So there are a lot of these tidbits he threw out there, some of which were just, you know, good for laughs, some of which were quite interesting, I thought. And if you guys remember any of these, by all means, you know, jump in.
Well, I remember them, but since we're not allowed to talk about what we watched, how are we gonna...
Well,
let's talk about what he told people about what was supposed to happen in Macross 2 that didn't happen.
That is an excellent point.
So let's let Richard take it from here. Oh, wait, where's Rich? Oh...
Sorry, Richard. Well, did you want to touch on that point?
Oh, no, I'll let you go, because it was all done in Japanese. So.
Okay, well, one point that was brought up was that the original plan for Macross 2 involved appearances by a lot more characters from the original Macross than actually ended up in it, i.e. no one. So... There was one example where we were discussing, for some reason, we were discussing Macross 2. I don't know why. Yeah. And the scene where there's a Zentradi is an ambassador or someone talking on a TV screen.
It seems more like he's some kind of like, priest or something, because he's got like the robe on. He's wearing something Zentradi's never worn.
Right.
Long live Koja!
Yeah.
And that was originally supposed to be Exidor.
Long live culture.
Oh, it's culture bonsai.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, is that what it is?
I think so.
Not in the English. Surely.
The subtitle, I should have it. I'm not...
I don't know.
So, the thing is, this is not something that is necessarily news, because Adrian and I have talked to the number one Macross fan in Japan in the past about what he thought the most prized part of his collection was. And this was a difficult question for him to answer. This is going back maybe 6 months. Because most of his collection is in boxes. But he did say that he had one of the original pitch documents, internal pitch documents, for Macross 2. Mm-hmm. And even he said, in this document, there were a lot more original Macross characters that were supposed to appear in Macross 2. And it all later got rewritten. Now, I would love to have a look at this document, but... He doesn't know where it is at the moment. He said it's at the bottom of a box somewhere. We don't know whether it's a page of text just describing the scenario or whether it's like a full-on booklet. For example, I've seen the original pitch documents for the original Yamato from the 70s, and that thing was like a small phone book, and it had like photographs for reference and clipped articles and sketches that had been photocopied and then pasted in. It was pretty huge. Amazing piece of history. So I'm sure it wasn't that detailed, but it was probably somewhere between those two extremes. But we were originally supposed to get a lot more original Macross characters in Macross 2, and it was interesting to hear someone involved in the production as opposed to hearing a fan talk about this.
But like, how would he know?
Could just be in the aftermath. He's talked to people, and
that could be Exidor. We don't know. He doesn't have a name.
Well, one thing that surprised me, compared to, you know, the Macross voice actors and singers, for example, I've come across in the past, I've listened to or met, he was really knowledgeable on Macross. Like, he was talking about wingspans of planes and... Like,
really?
Yeah, he was talking about how big, like, the I think it was the Macross Zero Fighters were compared
the
to...
VF-2JA.
Oh, that's right, my bad.
Specifically talking about that.
He was talking about how large it looked. He's like, you should compare these two things sometime. Like, this one is huge. And we should have asked him about the landing gear. But we didn't.
Yeah, it sounds like something he would know.
Well, he seemed really knowledgeable. And that was unusual, because I'm used to hearing, for example, Fukuyama at a concert, forgetting whether or not Basara lived or died at the end of Macross 7.
Well, did you watch Macross 2 with the commentary? Because he's on Takahashi
on the blue on the Blu-ray.
Yeah,
I haven't. No,
I have. I don't remember much of what he said, but I certainly noted his enthusiasm for the work. Himself. He's a huge fan of himself.
Well, you've got to wonder, was he a fan of Macross beforehand, or is it just that this is the main thing of note that he's really done in his career, and as such, he's parlayed as the years have gone by. But he hasn't had, as far as I know, that much interaction with fans. He's vaguely active on Twitter, on occasion. Hisame met him at the Nyan Nyan Cafe.
He was just
sitting there, and she recognized him and went up and introduced herself, and that's how this whole thing started.
How does he suddenly recognize him?
Because
if he's not that well known, his photograph isn't going to be everywhere.
No, but she's obviously, you know, seen pictures of him.
I think it's more like they recognize Hisame.
If she wasn't in costume, though.
No.
But yeah, so this is how all this started at the Nyan Nyan Cafe, which is why I wish that place still existed, because it's a sparking point.
Because the Nyan Nyan Cafe in the glass case had a signed Blu-ray by him.
It did. So. It did. Yeah, towards the end. So that's how this all started, and yeah, he seemed like a complete fan. He mentioned things like there's that scene, and I can't say which episode because I don't remember. You guys probably know where. It's the Roman Holiday episode, basically, where Ishtar meets back up with Feth, and Hibiki's filming from the bushes, and he jumps and runs out, and he trips while he's running towards her.
Yeah,
and he mentioned how he didn't know the trip was going to happen, so there's no sound effect or oomph for like him tripping over. So it's just like run, 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 silence. But actually, he fell flat in his face in the animation. So there are things like that he mentioned. The other really interesting thing that came up, though, in my opinion, was he mentioned the inspiration for Ishtar. And this isn't new to Macross. The creation of Minmay, as has been discussed many times in the forums, and as Richard has talked about it many times, was influenced by Akina Nakamori and Seiko Matsuda, both singers in the day. Seiko Matsuda being the queen of pop, and arguably still was until Ayumi Hamasaki took the title many, many years later. But in this case, there were two specific girls who were the inspiration for Ishtar. And I must note, this in the aftermath of this event, I contacted number one Macross fan, and I just wanted to clarify the names of these girls. And he was like, well, it's all written on page 25 of the This Is Animation special MOOC for Macross 2. And so I went and double-checked, and yes, there it was. So it's been I've overlooked it all these years. So who are these two people? The first one is Mia Masuda. And she was born in 1972. She started her career in 1987. And Takayama described her as a minor idol who never really made it into the big leagues and pretty much fell into obscurity shortly thereafter. She was kind of big in the day when they'll come out with Macross 2, but... and the other actress was Yumiko Takahashi. Not Rumiko Takahashi. Yumiko Takahashi. Who has been mentioned by Mikimoto in past articles as having had a personal influence on him with Ishtar's design. She was born in 1974. She started her career in 89. She's an actress, model, and singer. And she's still active today, as far as I know. She's in her early 40s. So, between the... hearing about the original potential cast of characters from Macross 2 and, you know, the influence for Ishtar, for what was a simple fan gathering, this turned out, I thought, to be quite an interesting little event, gathering. So is there anything that you guys, you know, remember or picked up from it, or...?
Yeah, I mean, apart from actual... watching some secret, you know, government video. Classified visual media. We did have a little Macross 2 questionnaire kind of quiz thing.
The pop quiz, Hotshot.
Yeah. And I don't know how hard those questions were supposed to be, but I know at least one of them was like a trick question.
Yeah.
Because you had to be on Twitter or something.
Oh.
But then apart from that, I think I got one wrong. I don't remember which one it was. I mean, excluding that one, the Twitter one. And apart from that, they were quite easy.
Okay,
so I felt like if you were a hardcore Micros 2 fan, which we all are, obviously.
Of course.
Yes.
Well, one was like how many girls appeared on the video phone call with Marsh?
That's the one I didn't get.
Really?
Yeah.
Jeez.
What do you mean? What?
Everyone memorizes like all the Marsh scenes. How could you get that one wrong? Like, we had problems with what was
that's
the name
not the Marsh scene.
The flagship. What was not the name, but the class? I think was it the class?
It had like
the UN Space Age flagship.
Yeah, and it had like was it the Heracles or something or other?
It was a Gloria, Heracles, and then some other thing.
Yeah,
I got the one. I remember the question about the Scramble News Network.
Is it, what does it stand for?
What does SNN stand for?
I got it right there.
And
server?
And when they were giving out the answers, Takayama-san was saying, yeah, it never appears in the actual animation, but this is what it stands for. And I said, no, it does appear in the animation. And he's like, well, what do you mean? I've seen this many times. And I said, it appears in the scene where Hibiki has to sign the apology letter, because it's
the letterhead.
It's the letterhead, yeah.
Wow, you showed him.
Yeah, and he was like, oh, shit.
You showed him.
Well, but there was also something else that I laughed, and no one else laughed while we were watching the thing.
The thing, okay.
And what was it? Because he asked me, he turned to me, and I'm like, you guys... He was looking at me with like, you know, you just walked off the street, you came like 2 hours late, what are you laughing at? And I can't remember what it was. It was some sign... in the background.
Okay.
That was in English. No, that was it. Nuns save our world or something like
that's...
that. And I've never noticed that before. And here we are in glorious Blu-ray.
What
I had to
being...
snicker. I mean 35mm print. I mean Super 8. I mean
it was VCD.
Yes. VHD.
That question on the survey that was the trick question, that was the one that screwed everyone up.
But some people still got it.
The number one Macross fan led this, kind of gave us a clue.
Yeah.
Oh, did he?
So basically, there was a question that was... So in the scene where Hibiki is captured by the military government and questioned...
Oh, yeah.
Like...
So you admit this is for propaganda? Never!
No, not the... The one where he's just at the table. I think it was after he was doing the elite broadcast.
Okay.
And you had like
still, it's the same thing.
The three
so
students.
You're a propagandist.
No, you know, he's in the middle of the table where there's no like way to enter the center, to get into the center of the table. He's that big round table. And there's no opening.
Well, he jumped
over.
He's an agile guy. You see him running in the opening.
Well, there were three kind of very government Agent Smith looking guys interrogating him.
Yeah.
And the question was, what Japanese like talent or celebrity was one of these guys influenced by or based off?
Oh, it's going to be that guy.
It was mentioned by Takayama in a tweet about 4 or 5 days earlier in the lead
Is
up to this gathering. No, it wasn't Tamori.
Oh, okay.
Tamori's too obvious, man. You had to go back through the Twitter. So I was like, what the heck is the answer to this? So I asked the number one Macross fan, and he was like, go look at Takayama's Twitter for the last week or so. I'm like, you saw me. I'm scrolling through my phone trying to find this comment. So at the end of it, we had, I think, six of us. Ended up with full marks. Adrian and myself included. So we're representing the Gaijin Butai. And as with all important decisions in Japan, it then came down to rock, paper, scissors. I have never won a game of rock, paper, scissors in my life. I did at that gathering.
Yay.
I was kind of shocked.
Yeah, you won pretty quick, too.
Yeah.
It's pretty much, I think, was it the first round?
It's the first round, yeah.
Yeah.
You want some signed Shikishi or something?
So he had basically one of the art cards from when the merchandise, all that merchandise came out for the Macross 2 Blu-ray release, and they
it's
had
still there.
The art cards. Some of it is. The art cards are.
Not the Ishtar art card. That's gone.
No, but this is.
This is, he says, he reaches into his pocket. Oh, the IC card seal. The IC card jacket, technically speaking.
Yes, it's a jacket, and I opened it up and it's a sticker.
So it was an autographed card, which the ironic thing is, since we knew he'd be there, everyone took something to get autographed, and I brought an art card from Macross too, but a different one to the one I won.
That's okay then.
So I was,
now I have a collection,
kind of lucky. But yeah, so that
it was, take a photo of him.
It was in a cheap 100 yen frame or something from some department store.
But what was interesting was there was a second prize.
There was.
Yeah.
And who won that?
Well, it went junking again to the remaining four guys.
Mm-hmm.
And I won. But I thought it was funny because the first round ended up with just three of us. And then the second round, I won. But then something was like, something went off or something. And they're like, we're not really sure. Did he win? And I was like, oh man, this is Richard all over again. They're going to make us start all over. And then the two fans go, nah, just give it to him. So, and it just turned out to be the Ichiban Kuji Ishtar.
The little petite.
The little thing. One, yeah.
Yeah.
Which I already had.
I've got to say, the one Macross 2 gathering that's kind of bringing it back, the most hardcore of hardcore Japanese fans, the number one Japanese fan, and who scoops the prize pool? Macro Speaker Podcast.
Yeah.
So, yay. Representing.
Yeah, but who brought the rarest item to get signed and gave one to Hisame for her birthday? That's right. Took one of the original, I think the only, maybe not the only, but it was a very rare pencil board, Shitajiki, with, and it's one of the, it's the graphic with, well, Hibiki right in the front and the Macross in the background. You barely see Ishtar. Basically, that big puzzle up there.
Yeah.
And
oh,
I,
that?
Yeah.
Yeah, the, so I got the pencil board of that?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's rare?
The pencil board's rare.
Oh, shit. I better buy it, because I saw it online.
If you can... Oh, if you saw Yahoo Auctions, he got it. 200 yen.
Auction. 300 yen I found on auction.
Yeah.
No, I've seen it on sale for 300.
Yeah.
So you can get it.
Order it right now.
If they have a bunch of stock, let me know. I'll buy them out. But, yeah, took that, got it signed, and even, he was saying, the voice actor for Hibiki was like, this is rare!
Nice.
And he was like, please sign it.
Okay. Well,
I didn't know that he was going to be there, so I didn't bring anything to get signed. So I just had my questionnaire, quiz, pop quiz, answer sheet signed by him, which is kind of lame, but, yeah.
It's something.
It's a memory.
I was really impressed at how approachable he was. I mean, he was a bit of a joker even. You know, he was just really approachable, easy to talk to. Yeah. I kind of wish I had more time to talk to him.
Yeah.
Because we had the screening of something, and then the quiz, and then autographs. And then afterwards, if you stuck around, we probably could have talked a bit more, but still, everyone was willing to shake his hand, and I should have talked to him a bit more during his commentary, but I didn't want to disturb him, you know.
And being at that event made me think of the t-shirt I've always wanted. So I was sitting there and everyone was taking the quiz and went on eBay and I went looking for that US Renditions Macross 2 promo shirt that was sold at like Anime Expo and whatever cons they did back then when all four of them back in 92. And just that week, somebody posted both shirts, the purple one and the black one, and it turned out to be from a relative of Kevin Seymour, who was the ADR director that apparently passed away the previous year, and that relative was selling his stuff off. So they were by now, I bought them, and when I went back home, had them sent there, picked them up, brought them back. Beautiful shirts.
Yeah?
Yep.
That is nice. Oh, it's the same design on both sides.
Yeah. You are right.
You know, Union Traditions made a lot of interesting shirts. They had a Gunbuster shirt that I bought, and I really love that shirt, and I don't know where it went.
Well, ask the guy if he has them. He's still going through the guy's collection.
Okay.
So, yeah, apparently it was from the ADR director. He passed away. The family's going through his stuff. And he's been putting it up for sale. Had a bunch of... I guess the guy worked on stuff all the way up until, like, 2000s.
Hmm.
He had standalone complex stuff.
Wow.
box sets. But this shirt is like perfect. And I've always wanted to get this shirt because I didn't buy it at the con because they were expensive. But it's the only shirt with Ishtar and the new UN Spacey logo.
Hmm.
So you're going to wear that around the camp right now, I suppose, right?
No, I'm going to wear it at events, official events, because I want to show Big West, like, this is official, even though you don't know about it. It's official merch.
If you were to say, show that to someone who might be an artist, what might they say about it?
Well, I showed Tenjin the picture of the pic. He's like, oh, I got these while I was in the U.S.
The shirts?
Yeah, when I met him, I'm like, oh, check this out. He's like, what? Is that official? I said, 100% official. Yeah, there's Big West copyright, U.S. rendition is licensing. He just goes.
Big West copyright actually on there.
Yeah, it's on there.
Macross 2 is a trademark of Big West, Macross 2 Projects. 92, 93, Big West, Macross 2 Project. All rights reserved. Reckless Regional... I can't read the rest of it. Something throughout the...
United States and Canada by LA Hero.
Oh, licensed, probably.
Yeah, or distribution or whatever.
LA Hero.
Oh, well, I showed a photo of the shirt's cool. Tangent. And like, he zoomed in. And he's like, ah, not a very good artist.
Haruhiko Mikimoto.
And he's like,
learn something from Tenjin.
Pretty much was kind of like, no, this isn't. This is obviously not a Mikimoto art.
Well, I don't want to ruin your day, but
I'm pretty sure
they forgot to crop out the white background.
That's the exact same thing Tenjin said. He's like, this is supposed. This part is you're supposed to be able to see through this. You should see the T-shirt here. And I'm like, you just can't let me have my day, Tenjin,
right now, baby. Yeah.
Now, obviously, this is probably they found an artist that just do the scene at the end.
Yeah.
And they probably because you know this is that shot where the camera pans.
Yeah, it's the ending credits.
Right? Yeah. So they probably just took like digital shots of it, and then the guy traced over it.
Well, that's good. I like it. I'll probably wear it around.
For a t-shirt, yeah.
Yeah.
They pop up every once in a while on eBay, but they're always used and ratted and tattered.
Hmm.
And these are, like, brand new.
To briefly jump back there, I mean, any final impressions from this fan gathering? Any takeaways?
Well, I thought it was really interesting. It was really fun. I like these kind of gatherings because, you know, you get to meet different types of fans. Some of them were new. I never...
Yeah, that's
some people we knew.
For me, but it's all about the fan culture because that's the one thing we have in Japan that you know it can't be transmitted digitally, it can't be bootlegged. It's real, it's grassroots, and you know whether it be doujin artists, fan merchandise, a comic kit, or something like this. One of the fans we ran into then, and it's not the first time I've run into her, but she's a younger Macross 2 fan, and yes, they exist. She's only like 22 or something, and it obviously seemed Frontier.
Is that the girl who was wearing the white dress?
The one who's Ishtar, yeah. She said about 2 years ago, maybe, she had seen Macross 2 on broadcast, so probably on Animax, when they did the anniversary screenings.
They were showing the whole thing.
And she said she was immediately just captured by how gorgeous Ishtar is. She said she was under her spell. And since then... She only really does, as far as I've seen, two types of cosplay. Either Ishtar or from Macross the Music Culture.
That's hardcore.
And she was talking to some other fans at this event, and I was listening to them, and they were talking about getting together to do a Music Culture cosplay shoot. So they're keeping that part of the fandom alive, that memory of something that doesn't exist recorded anywhere, so I think that's really great. And everyone in the room at one point, before you were there, I think, Renato, was singing the Zentron song. From the Music Culture. And Vigo. I was like, yeah, the Vigo song. And that's not recorded anywhere. The one video of it doesn't exist. They took it off YouTube. So again, this is kind of this grassroots communication of this culture, which, you know, for everyone's complaining that, oh, this needs to be put on a DVD, this needs to be put on a CD, which I won't disagree with. The fact that it's having to be conveyed like this, it's really old school. And it's really interesting that it still exists, you know.
I like that it's kind of multi-generational as well. That's one aspect that wasn't old school, right?
if you talk about old school, you're talking about, like, you know, back in the Yamato days, right? But, like, everyone grew up with that, so they're all the same generation. But these guys...
Yeah, they're all different ages, yeah.
Different age groups. Everyone came into it through something else.
Right.
So it's always very interesting for me.
Yeah.
Adrian, what do you... As the biggest Macross fan here... Macross 2 fan, rather. Here.
Oh, no, it was great. I mean, I'm glad somebody put it together. And
yeah, kudos to her.
Yeah. And it was small. Not because, you know, lack of fans. It was just something that she could do. She put it together and... It wasn't an official event, so it's kind of had to keep it hush-hush, and, you know, I hope she does something else. Matter of fact, why don't you do, like, a Dynamite 7 one?
Yeah, Renato, why don't you?
Why don't I do it?
Yeah.
Because I don't know anyone.
You don't know anyone.
I'm not on Twitter for a
moment. I'll bring the people.
Oh, you bring the people.
You just build it. I'll bring the people.
Build it.
If I build it, they will come.
Build it, Adrian will come.
Yeah. Come on, people.
Exactly. They will call it that.
Yes.
So, no, it was really good event. You know, they had the little gimmicks. You walk in, you had a pool, a random number, and you couldn't sit with, like, if you came with somebody, you had to sit with somebody else. Yeah, right. It was all random. And then in the middle of it, they switched it again.
Yeah. So they're trying to keep the call to you with exchange, fan exchange.
Yeah.
Going.
And
the name tags.
yeah, the name tags are pretty cool because they're supposed to be like access passes for the SNN.
Mm-hmm.
And if they didn't have your picture or whatever you wanted on there, they just used your Twitter handle picture.
And what was your Twitter handle picture?
Oh, that was easy. It was Arikita from Yomushipero.
On an SNS access pass.
SNN.
Yasutomo.
And the curry was pretty good too.
Oh yeah, we got food and drinks and stuff. So yeah. Alright, so moving on. It's long goodbye. Sayonara, sayonara. Nando date. Chibun ni mujo ni ikikasete. Te o furu no wa yasashisa da yo ne.強さが欲しいあなたに出会い、輝いて、私が生まれて愛すれば、こそ愛あれば、こそ希望のない奇跡を待って、どうなるの？涙に滲む 星の瞬きは5。アルカリア発信! So, just the other day, Mr. K, who is a known staff member at Arcadia, who are the fine makers of high-end Valkyrie toys, put up a blog post which went into detail, as much detail as he could, given his position and how much he's allowed to say, on the creation process of Arcadia's toys. Why did he do this? Because Arcadia's been copying a lot of criticism from the fan base recently due to the price of their Valkyries as of late. This started around their third iteration of the 19, but has really become obvious with the Macross Zero Valks. So we've had the Zero D, and we just got the Zero A, and these are Valkyries that are all pushing, well, they broke the 30,000 yen mark, and if you're going by the recommended retail price, they're pushing the 35,000 or 37,000 yen. So you're getting between $350 or so US, I guess, very roughly speaking, before postage or taxes or any of that, depending on where you're ordering from, if you're an overseas fan. But even in Japan, obviously, people must have been saying they were expensive, because that's what this was a reply to. And this was rather unprecedented. A bit of pulling back the curtain. There wasn't a lot said in the article, I think, that those of us who followed Arcadia and Yamato before them weren't aware of. But it was something new. And Renato, you were good enough to throw together, very, very quickly, a translation of the piece.
Yes.
You sound like I accused you of something here.
Well, yeah, that was me. So,
my bad.
So, why don't you talk about who Mr. K is and who he isn't, so we can clear up any...
Well, can I say who he isn't, and can you say who he is?
Okay.
So, the K in Mr. K, it does not stand for a King of Fighters character.
Oh, man.
Because he puts... Oh, sometimes I've seen a dash next to his name.
K-dash.
But no, Mr. K is not Shoji Kawamori. A lot of people seem to make this mistake. Yeah. Shoji Kawamori works for Satellite.
Yes.
And he also does work freelance, really. And Mr. K is an employee of Arcadia Toys.
Formerly employed at Yamato Toys as well.
And so I know, like, you've introduced me to him, Adrian, at Wonderfest and events like that. I've talked to him once or twice. From your interactions with him, what would you think his general work or position kind of is?
He's in charge primarily with overlooking the Macross toys that Yamato did, and now he's seems to even be the only... Okay, I wouldn't say he's the only one, but at Yamato Toys, he was working on stuff, mostly Macross and a little other things, and then Yanagisawa was also kind of more in control. He was kind of juggling different things until Dolls came in, and then he went to Dolls, and Kay kind of took over all the Macross stuff.
Okay.
And with Arcadia, it looks like he's just handling all the Macross development. Now... he's not the one that decides what they make. He's the one that handles it, looks after it, checks everything. He's the one to try to get the product out the door as best as possible, without signing his life away. So
general, what we'd call this, general manager, general producer of the product line, something like that?
I would say he's the producer of the product. Because he's the one that is in charge of making sure once it's greenlit, he pretty much has to report everything and deal with all that. But he doesn't deal with...
specifics?
Yeah, I mean, he's not the one going out to get the license. He's not the one dealing probably directly with Big West as far as getting approvals. He's probably getting notes and then making those changes with the factory. He does, however... is in contact with some of the original artists when they're in development, because when they did the Macross, they had Miyatake come down and give feedback on it. So
he'd have to come down because they couldn't phone him because he doesn't have a phone.
Yeah, because I do remember at the launch ceremony they had one out there, and when Miyatake was there, they brought him out and they're getting his feedback on it. But he's a really nice guy. When he was at Yamato and he was working on the Macross, and I had went there and they were letting me transform it, he was the one that came down to show me how to transform it, and I didn't even want to. I was like, you do it. just show me how to do it. I don't want to do it. And I was saying, why didn't Yamato do the TV version? And he was the one that said, I wanted the TV version, but I lost the vote. So he's not the decider of what Arcadia makes. He's just the one in charge of... he's got the history with the transformable toys, so he deals with it.
He was, correct me if I'm wrong, he was there when we went to the open showroom for the VF4?
He should have been there, I think.
He's the one who's always wearing the gloves.
Yeah.
And usually the hat.
So in all those photos you see on the blogs when they're doing test samples, you always see the gloves.
Yes. Right. Yeah, that's him.
Right.
And of course,
I
was going to say, the K stands for his, you know, family name, I'm sure.
There's a couple of videos that I put up on YouTube years ago at the showroom events.
Mm-hmm.
They're mostly me mistransforming stuff, but usually he's next to me. That's him.
Yeah. Okay. So how did he react to you breaking all the Valkyries?
He was looking away at the time.
And of course, previously of Yamato Toys, now at Arcadia, which... And of course, we don't know specifics here, there's some conjecture, but how big would we think Arcadia is? Because a lot of people do, and this is an understandable comparison, although I consider it to be an inapt one, compare Bandai and Arcadia because they both have separate Macross licenses for Valkyries. Bandai is probably one of the top three toy manufacturers of the world. It's huge. Whereas Arcadia, I mean, how many people do we think we're looking at? Just at a guess.
I'd say between 15 and 20 people.
So it's... That's what? Small to medium-sized.
Yeah.
Probably. So we're talking about a small company. Not as small, if what I've heard is correct, as, you know, something like Evolution Toys, which would be even smaller. But when...
Because
some,
it's a house.
It's a house.
Street view.
Where Adrian zooms up on the mailbox.
Yeah. No, it could be even less. I think about it. Yamato might have been between 15 and 20.
Because at least they had an office.
Because they had a fairly big office. When they first started, they were in Kurama.
Uh-huh.
Then they moved to Akihabara, which was above Cocos. And before you guys went to the open house, they occupied that entire floor.
Mm.
And then 2 years before, maybe 3 years before they closed up, they cut it to half the office space.
Yeah.
And I have only been in the showroom part of Arcadia's old office, which was in Akihabara. And that was pretty tiny. Mm. But I didn't actually see the office space. I just saw where you walk in and they have some glass cabinets and a table to meet.
Right.
And they recently moved... Well, I wouldn't say recently, but I think sometime last year, they moved back to Kurama.
Hmm.
So I have no idea how big their office is right now. So I'm guessing maybe 10 to 12 people. Because they don't really have a lot of people manning the booth. And the people that I do see at the smaller shows that are the industry, there's usually no more than two people at a booth. Okay, it's not even a booth. Let's say it's basically a table with product on it. Then two people behind it. That's it.
All right. So, Renato, would you like to... I'm going to presume most people listening to this have read your translation, but for those that haven't, would you like to give, like, the brief Cliff Notes version?
No, I was actually going to say, stop this recording right now. And, stop the playback of the recording if you're listening to this and haven't read it, and then press play again if you have read it. You want me to give the cliff notes? I can give the cliff notes. It's just Mr. K saying, well, why do people think that it's expensive? Well, there's a number of factors. One factor is obviously it's not the same as 10 years ago in terms of factory costs, factory fees, rather. The prices for factory labor have gone up because fees have gone up in China, because China's economy has taken off. Okay, great. But we're not going to talk about that. We're going to talk about why our company is... it has the image of being expensive as far as what people are saying on Twitter or whatever. And so putting those global issues, so-called global issues, aside, it has a lot to do with the standard, the quality standards that Arcadia seems to strive for in their manufactured... product.
Right.
That's really what it boils down to.
So there was a lot of talk of factory costs.
Yes.
scrap percentages.
Yes.
That was rather surprising.
Right.
They had a very high percentage of scrap.
Yeah. They didn't talk about it openly like that, but at one of the... I think it was at one of the open houses... It could have been there, or it was when I met them before, mm-hmm. when they used to make that kind of polarized windshield on the 160s, and people didn't like that.
Yeah, yeah.
They said those were being like maybe 8 out of 10 would get rejected because they were off.
Wow.
And then, but then people didn't like it anyways.
Yeah, so they stopped doing them after a while.
So some of the scrap percentages discussed in this article, for example, the scrap proportion of die-cast parts is around 36%, meaning a third of all die-cast parts are not usable. And then if you're talking about things like plastic molding errors and painting errors, that can be up around the 65 to 78% mark, which is closer to, as you said, 8 out of 10 being unusable. So that seems to match with that.
Yeah.
So that is...
That's not miss molded parts. That's parts that were molded probably perfectly fine,
mm-hmm.
but some on another process screwed up.
So like painting or something? Or?
Painting or the tempo stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Tolerances that are off, not fitting into another piece.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So they discuss the high amount of scrap, increasing costs of Chinese factories, needing to cover their overhead, their staff costs, things like that. And he discussed the high amount of scrap in the factories was attributed, according to the article at least, to Arcadia's high standards of quality. This is not to say necessarily quality control, but their quality standards. They're very exacting on their factory, and they're demanding a level of quality, according to them at least, that you don't normally see in toys. Renato, having had Adrian as well, you guys are both more toy people than me, but going by Arcadia and Yamato before them, how does this kind of statement stack up to you from your experience with their products?
Well, I'll tell you from my experience with Yamato, right?
Okay.
Speaking to him and speaking to the other guy that Adrian mentioned earlier, Yanagisawa-san, who was also on the Macross team, as it were. I asked them, like, years ago about their product becoming more and more expensive.
Okay.
Right? And I said to them, and also, you do know that Japan is undergoing a social crisis right now with the decreasing... birth rate and therefore decreasing population and therefore the market is shrinking, right? How are you going to survive? Having no idea that, of course, Yamato's demise would be around the corner. And they said, we're okay. And I said, well, like, for example, Takara Tomy are shifting their factories over to, like, Vietnam and places like that. And he said, the prices are increasing because, you know, the factory costs are increasing. But we demand an extremely high level of detail, high level of quality, and only this factory can provide us with that. We don't want to move factories out of the question. And the R2... And this was, like, 3 years ago, at least. And the article... when was it? Yesterday that I finished the translation?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's basically saying the same thing. So, they're staying put at this factory. They have a... You know, I don't know if they have a long relationship. Like, I don't know how close they are to the people who are working there. But they know, realistically, what kind of product they can expect given the high standards that they demand from them, right? So... they are not going to go to a cheaper factory and cut corners or whatever, because really, their in my opinion, this is my opinion now, mm-hmm. in my opinion, their survival depends on recognition that Arcadia is kind of like this really, really high standard no BS company that isn't going to give you a subpar product. Yep. Unlike some other. Unlike, let's say it, Takara Tomy. All right. Now, I bought recently two Optimus Primes. Last year, I bought a Masterpiece MP10 Optimus Prime. Actually, it's not MT10.
They just reissued that, right? The Masterpiece.
Okay, yeah, wait. But last year, I bought the Hasbro one,
because they reissued it for the Asian market, which is you know, Hong Kong, China, all these countries outside of Japan. But it's a Hasbro version. I found it was okay. Paint application a little bit sloppy, but it was fine. Better than what people are saying about the American one, which is loosey goosey, whatever. And then they just reissued the MP10 for Japan, as you just said.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been reading the reviews on Amazon because I bought one for 20 whatever thousand yen it was.
Mm-hmm.
And it's okay, but like, parts fit is pretty bad. The Hasbro one is better. And yesterday, last night, I was checking the entry at Amazon again, and they have halved the price. And I'm looking at the reviews, and they're all bad. Like, even people who have put 4 or 5 stars are saying, yeah, but take this with a grain of salt because, you know, you might get lucky and get a good one, but more than likely you're going to get some things screwed up with it. And it's got an odd amount of 1-star reviews. They've got a lot [S2] Wow. [S1] Of people saying, you know, people are saying that this is supposed to be the, or rather Takaratomi themselves are saying that this is supposed to be the be-all and end-all of Masterpiece Transformers.
Are these issues that previous versions of the toy had? Or
apparently
these...
not.
Well, wow.
Yeah, this is a separate entry for the reissue. Because there's a guy on there, you know, I read them all. There's a guy on there that had the 2010 one, because that mold is already 4 years old. 5. And he said, yeah, the old one didn't have these problems. Hmm. It should be the same thing. The packaging, everything is the same. But I guess, you know, maybe the mold is warped, or maybe it's because they changed their factory to a lower quality one. I don't know.
Yeah, they probably moved it to a different factory, and it's a whole new ball game for a bunch of people learning.
Hmm.
Okay, but we're looking at similar... I don't know how similar you would say, but like they're basically in the same subgenre, right? Of high-end quality toys that are going over the 22,000 yen mark.
Hmm.
And I like Optimus Prime, but this is the difference between night and day. You're not going to put a YF-19 with wings sharp enough to draw blood against you know, this chunky robot box.
Hmm.
You know,
I mean, Adrian, going from your experience with like handling some of these products, I mean, quality wise
I haven't bought a toy in a while.
Hmm.
So I haven't really handled anything Bandai or Hasbro. Just hear a lot of other people. Renata always has stories about people complaining about this isn't broken, but I just don't hear it.
Mm.
So I don't have anything to compare it to. But what I can say is, I would, if I got an Optimus Prime that was for the US market under the Hasbro brand and it fell apart at Toys R Us, it's Toys R Us, I can just take it back, and they'll exchange it for another one, or give my money back, or store credit, whatever. And it's just easy to just kind of like shake it off. In Japan, that doesn't work like that. So if I buy it here, I'm kind of stuck with it.
Hmm.
Or I have to mail it back to the company and see if there isn't a replacement and if they can send me another one. If not, it's kind of like no cooling off period, which means you're screwed.
Hmm.
And they just send it back to you because they don't have anything to send you. And it's just you know, the typical Japanese, you know, moshiwake arimasen, which basically means you're shit out of luck. And our apology doesn't mean anything, but we technically have to say sorry. But I would expect more from Takaratomi, which, you know, runs Hasbro, which Hasbro has, you know, a film division because of the Transformers movies, and they go and make movies like Battleship and this, and they've got all these avenues of revenue to make a really good toy, what I would expect from them, and I would expect to get perfect customer service, and you don't even get that. So they have all this ways of getting money to develop these toys, and they should be close to what I would expect to get if it's a masterpiece line. Arcadia doesn't have any of that. They don't have film division. They don't have international distribution for Macross.
Yeah, that's actually an interesting point that I don't think people talk about enough. I'm sorry to bring this up. If Harmony Gold wasn't in the way, and they could distribute these products internationally, obviously their production numbers would go up, right? And that should offset the price.
Yeah.
At the same time, they'd have a lot more rejected material.
The comparison I made on a different forum recently, because people were doing these one-to-one comparisons with Bandai.
Yeah.
And, like, you guys know me. I will buy a Valkyrie if I'm really into it. The last...
Yeah, but you'd leave it in the box.
So let me finish. The last Yamato or Arcadia Valk I bought was the VF4.
Yeah, how's that holding up?
And I got extensive hands-on time with it at the introduction event, preview event.
Lucky so.
And that thing is a miracle of engineering. I mean, I'm not the most experienced toy person, but I have never felt anything that is both so detailed and so solid in a commercial toy product ever. Like, it was a revelation. I was shocked. Having said that, expensive toys are expensive toys. Since then, I've bought maybe 3 Bandai Valks, but I have the Arcadia VF0S on pre-order, ready to go. So this December, it will be coming. It will be the second most important thing coming in December, the most important thing coming being the 2SS.
And that's still coming.
That's still coming.
I haven't heard anything about it.
But, so I have faith in their products. I know they're good quality. I can't afford them. I can see how if you had OCD, you want to collect them all. You have to realize Arcadia Valkyries are not Pokemon. They are high-end collectibles. You get the one you'd like. Normal people can't afford all of them. And then, to bring this back to your comparison, Adrian, so someone was doing this comparison to Bandai, and I said, well, look, if you look at everything Bandai has, the size of the company, all these other toy lines, which can cover the red ink in other toy lines, they probably own their own damn factories, whereas Arcadia is...
It's in Saitama.
That's for the injection molding for model kits. So those are all still made in Japan. Toys are still done outside, but I mean, that's probably through... I mean, they have Bandai Asia. Bandai isn't... that has distribution throughout Asia for Gundam stuff, so it's not through Bandai Asia... There's Bandai America that distributes Power Ranger stuff because that's their biggest selling item overseas. Bluefin distributes their niche stuff like Gundam, and those go to Borders bookstores because Dragon Ball, because stuff like that. Because Power Rangers outsells everything as far as Bandai goes.
So you guys are describing to me a company that has production lines, that has distribution networks, that has its own factories. Arcadia, last I heard when they were doing their factory time, I talked to them during the VF4 before they became Arcadia. They were talking about how they had to get factory time at that factory. So it's not like they can do whatever they want. It's not only these tolerances and scrap ratios. They've got limited time bought out at that factory, and they have to have the staff trained to be able to do this. They don't have any of these resources that Bandai has. Bandai is like a watermelon, whereas Arcadia is like a lollipop, a watermelon flavored lollipop. And as for Evolution Toys, I don't know, they could be a Tic Tac for all I know, and we don't know. So apart from feeling really hungry right now, apart from making myself hungry, economies of scale here, all the parts that are made and materials that are used by Bandai are monumentally cheaper just through the bulk that they're using. Again, things I don't think people take into account.
What would you say if someone told you that in that case Arcadia is crazy to go into this high-end stuff, which is something that Bandai and Takaratomi can afford to do because they are built upon the foundation of all this other stuff? You know, it's like a pyramid. Like, the peak of the pyramid is fed into by all this other junk that surrounds it. But with Arcadia, that's it. That's their product. That's what they focus on. If someone said to you, which I think I read on the boards, I'm not sure, that they shouldn't have so much high standards, and they should produce, you know, even if it's a lower quality version of the VF whatever 9, let's say, at a cheap and affordable price.
Are you
price.
Trying to tell me there's a 9 coming?
No, I'm not. I'm saying if they, you know, because they haven't made stuff like that. You know, one of the main critiques is that, oh, they're going back and doing the Macro Zero stuff again, so it's just like 2004.
And yet, keep going.
So there's more Valkyries that hardcore, ultra-hardcore fans want them to make, which would be a license to print money, which isn't a phrase that is way, way overused, in my opinion.
Right.
But like, would you go for that? Like a really cheapo, crappy stuff that would usually get rejected. Would you buy Toynami quality
VF9,
basically, VF9. From Arcadia?
Is this a general direction directed question, or is this just a...
Well, it's... Yeah. Okay, well, you guys. I don't know. I mean,
I've got an opinion.
That's
on
the
it.
Sense that I'm getting from a couple of the comments that I read.
I've got a pre-existing opinion on this. I can jump into it. It might be slightly long.
All I can say is, whether it's Arcadia or Yamato, they just have a history of developing something that at the time Bandai wasn't making anything for. Bandai didn't come out and make, you know, perfect transforming Valkyries. They made the Fire Valk.
Yes.
During Macross 7,
mm-hmm.
and even though that was a decent selling show, they put no money in the development of that Valk.
Yeah.
And they repainted it and they sold it. And they even did chrome limited versions of it.
Yes.
And Yamato Toys is the one that actually tried putting more gimmicks and stuff, more diecast and stuff, making it reflect stuff from what we grew up on.
Mm-hmm.
They started with the VF, with the Macross Plus toys, which were really boxy.
Really rough.
And really rough, but at the time, they were badass. And then they did the VF1s, and I mean, for me, there's things I didn't like about them, so I didn't buy into them. But I didn't criticize them for making those choices.
Mm-hmm.
I just said, that's not for me. I didn't sit there and go, oh, well, I'll just wait for the next batch, which was going to be the 148.
Mm.
I didn't know. I didn't expect that. There was nothing to expect anything from that company, but they kept delivering. And the only thing they've ever done is up the quality.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Bandai has always been like... it seems to me that Bandai always has their finger on the pulse of what the competitors are doing. You know, and they want to get into that.
Hence the 19 Advance.
Hence the 19 Advance. Hence, the VF1. You just mentioned the 160 VF1s, right?
Mm-hmm.
The first batch, before the 148. So, Bandai timed their re-release of the 155s to coincide with that. They would not have done that if Yamato had not said, hey, look, we're going to do VF1s now. Yeah. I guarantee you.
Well, to answer your question, I wouldn't want an inferior quality product. I am, however, as I've said in the past, a fan of variety, even if it may be less quality in the variety. But the thing is this, when people say, you know, why doesn't Bandai do this? Well, Bandai doesn't do stuff that they don't think is going to make them money. Arcadia is taking a risk on these things. They were from the Yamato days. They are now. And the thing is, it's not like anyone else is going to pick these licenses up. This Mr. K began as a huge Macross fan, still is a huge Macross fan. So this is a company by the fans, run for the fans. It knows the hardcore market. It's not trying to... Like, you could try to make these toys... Okay, let's say we gave the Macross Zero license to Bandai. They could make them cheaper. They're not going to sell any more. Bandai makes their money through either the really retro stuff, which they don't make a bulk of, the original Macross stuff, but they have their finger on whatever's new. So the Frontier stuff is where they make all their money. And when they can reuse a bunch of Frontier parts to then make Macross 30 Valkyries, they're also going to get milk that for what they can. But Bandai, again, you can walk into toy shops and buy Bandai Valkyries, and they're they're more mass market. It's still not mass market in the way Gundam is, but they're more mass, far more mass market than Arcadia. Apart from your hardcore adult collectors, no one, and Macross fans, no one knows who Arcadia is.
Yeah.
Whereas anyone in my office knows who Bandai is. So it's not a why can't they do this? It's a binary proposition. You either have them and they do this, or they're gone, and you don't get any product from this line because no one else will pick it up. No one else wants to take the risk, and no one else will deliver their quality. So you're either paying the price to get really good quality,
yeah,
or you don't pay the price and you get nothing because no one else will pick it up.
Yeah, so basically, Arcadia, what they're banking on is this high quality, right? They're not going to drop down their quality. They're not going to give you a, you know, a more affordable VF9 thing just so they can produce a really rare thing. Because if they do that, it means that also Bandai can do that, right?
Right.
It proves to, they're basically doing Bandai's market research for them. If they sell like hotcakes with an inferior quality product, all Bandai has to do is make that their next Chogokin, and there you go. That's it. So they can only compete by going after that peak of the pyramid, even though they don't have the surrounding junk foundation.
And if you were to tell me, well, that's a declining peak, given demographics,
yes,
and trends in Japan, robots and toys do not sell like they used to, I would 100% agree with that. But their market is internationally is not being limited because of their decisions. It's being limited by outside factors. So they're kind of a victim of circumstance, and they have to double down on the Japanese market regardless. Yeah. And the Japanese market wants quality. They can't cater to the foreign market. And to give you a very brief example of that, which isn't Arcadia, when I was at Wonderfest, and I'll probably go into this in more detail in a future podcast, I spoke with a representative from Evolution Toys about the 2SS. And one of the suggestions, I was like, look, and this was actually...
One of your suggestions?
I was going to say, I gave him a suggestion that was actually a message. I was just like the canine with the barrel around his neck and the handwritten note from Adrian saying, you're going to get a bunch of sales from overseas. Why not put an English version of the instructions in with this toy? And there was a bit of umming and ahhing and a bit of shifting of the feet, as well as kind of going white, and I was told, look, we can't. This is a contract condition. We cannot appeal in any way to the English-speaking market. That we can't put English in the manual at all. We know it would be good if we could. We're going to make the photographs, the pictures, the diagrams as large and easy to understand without knowing Japanese as we can. But we are contractually bound to not put English in this because of the potential ramifications of certain, again, external factors, other parties, we might say.
Hey, Adrian, you better not wear your t-shirt.
So,
like, beat up.
Then people have, I've heard people say, well, you know, Arcadia are obviously idiots for staying with this nefarious, notorious factory, charging them far higher rates than they should for these terribly high scrap percentages. And all I can say to that is, from both what that article said and what we've discussed, Adrian, based on what you've told me you've heard, it all comes down to their quality. And if they were to move factories, they have to train the staff from scratch. You'd have one or two product lines would become Optimus Prime and not be as good quality.
Yeah.
It, as a small company, they're already negotiating months and months, if not years in advance, for this factory time as it is. It's just not something that is... Changing is not something that's feasible for them. And the high scrap rate is not necessarily the factory's fault. It is because they have such a high standard they're trying to stick to for this tip of the pyramid you're talking about. So it's all connected.
Yeah. Well, I guess the elephant in the room is... Since we're saying Arcadia...
So that's not an elephant, is it? I don't...
That's
anyway.
Like, what the hell is that? That's an underfed elephant. I forgot what the elephant in the room is! So, if Arcadia's survivability depends... Is that a word? I think so.
Depends is a word, yes.
On... Yes, thank you. This high-quality product...
Mm-hmm.
are they high quality products? So none of us have any. Okay. Well, I have the YF-19.
Okay.
So the reason I'm mentioning this is because the VF-0A just came out,
mm-hmm.
and I'm looking at Macross World. Well, not right now, but I was this morning, and everyone's complaining about some parts being not very good, some parts popping off or something. I don't know. I'm sorry.
I think it was right.
So it's either the hips or the ankles again.
Mm.
Some die-cast ball joint. And some plastic. Right.
So you're saying
that goes over it.
Well, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think we need to differentiate between standards of quality and quality control. That's one important distinction to make. Not to defend those defects. They are not something we should really condone in such an expensive product. Also, though, I think when they changed over to Arcadia, two things happened. I think, while, if again, Adrian, I think you've mentioned a lot of the same stuff seemed to have come over, but mm-hmm. I think there was still some reshuffling of the guard and some training involved. I know they didn't change factories, but I'm sure there was some picking up of the slack when they downsized potentially to become Arcadia. And among that, we know from previously talking to Mr. K that these Macross Zero Valks, while they look like they are refined versions of the older ones from 10 years ago. They're not. They are
the brand new
yeah. molds. They are done from scratch. As such, there is a certain amount, for better or worse, of a learning process in what works and what doesn't work. And I think
we're talking about joint systems, though. I mean, they should have that down by now.
Well, it does sound like, if what you're saying is correct, the QC needs to be improved. But I think a lot of people are also at the same time under the illusion that these are just touched up old ones, which they should then therefore be better. But there's nothing that they've come out and said to say these are 100% new. That's what they said to us in person at Wonderfest.
No. The PR, the copy,
okay,
that they use is Shinki Seisaku.
I wonder if that's makes it that much into the English-speaking world, because I don't hear many fans saying that.
The people who are complaining about the joints being off...
Mm-hmm. They know this?
They know...
Okay.
...about the differences between the Yamato versions and these new versions.
Okay.
Don't worry. There's no confusion there. I mean, there are... Unless you're looking at the... the feed on Facebook or something, where can I get this, and blah, blah, blah. When are they coming to Chile or whatever? Then that's really the only time that people are going to get confused. I think we shouldn't underestimate.
No, the that's hardcore true. No, no, I don't underestimate them. Buying the product
for the last 20 years, 15.
No, I am in awe of them, but I am also never underestimating the significance of a language barrier, as your translation of this article really pointed out, because there were some things in there that I thought were common knowledge and are pretty logical, and people were like, wow, this provided such insight, I never thought of it like this. It's like, but this isn't the first time people in the industry have said this stuff, but it's never been said in English, really.
Well, it's never been said by somebody working for the company either.
True.
Yeah, he's been very candid. I mean, but he always was. And that's another thing. It kind of goes back to your point about Arcadia being a kind of a small company grassroots thing,
mm-hmm.
because this is basically a doujin company that just happens to be doing everything by the book and licensing stuff.
The doujin lollipop.
It's like a garage kit company producing their own Macross lollipops. Yes.
All right, we're done.
Except they don't suck.
Well,
or maybe they do. I don't.
One thing I was thinking was, because I just came back a week and a half ago,
mm-hmm.
from the States, and I had heard somebody say that he was going to put this post up. So there was word that a post was coming. Like, he made a tweet saying he was going to address the cost before this actually went up.
Yeah.
So I did hear that before it went up. And then, so I'm wondering, did they do the surveys again this year at Wonderfest? Because they usually do a survey.
Right.
And I'm wondering if it was a survey they did this past Wonderfest, Because obviously, he does get a lot of tweets from overseas collectors saying, why, make this.
Why?
But unfortunately, I mean, I'm sure there's nothing, it's not, he doesn't ignore them, but
nothing you can do.
They don't have an effect on what he can do or can't do.
I must admit, I checked out all of Wonderfest this year. I did the Arcadia booth, got the pictures, drilled at the Megazone stuff, and
yeah, because usually they do have, they give out stuff, and there's like a little,
they have the baskets with badges if you do
if you do something. I'm guessing because the Zero A came out, or Zero D, whatever.
Zero D would be out then, yeah.
They're getting feedback, and unless they have a feedback section on their website, I haven't been on it, but I'm guessing maybe it's because of Wonderfest. They've got feedback, and he's addressing it, because it's not the feedback from the overseas consumer, because you technically don't exist.
It's a fair point.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's wrap it up, because I think we've pretty much covered all the angles we can. Any final words or things you want to bring up on regarding Arcadia?
I read through some of the posts, and they're exactly what I was expecting from certain users. And people talked about licensing.
Oh yeah, we didn't mention.
And the thing is licensing costs are negotiated, and he's not going to publicly tell you what they're paying on licensing or what the percentage is, who gets what.
But the point is, it is a cost that needs to be factored into.
Yeah, and it's high. It's going to be high, especially for Macross.
Yeah.
And I mean, as much as, you know, we defend Big West, they're also known for making things difficult for their licensor. Yeah. Just hands down, everyone that works for them has a story about working with them.
They're a business.
Yeah, they're a very...
Well, not just...
Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, well, they're not just a regular business, like Adrian is saying. Like, they're notorious for that. Especially... I had a talk with a certain person at Bandai Visual around the time when the Blu-ray box set was being prepared, so it was going to come out at the end of that year.
Mm-hmm.
And I had lunch with this guy, and then he was going off to interview Ishiguro-san.
Okay.
Ishiguro Noboru, mm-hmm. the director. So this was just a couple of months before he died, right? And he was saying, yeah, and I have to interview him. He's a nice guy, but you know, this box set, oh my God, I have no idea how expensive it's going to be. And I'm like, well, what do you mean? And he said, yeah, you know, we suggested a price, and then said, yeah, raise it by like whatever, 10 or 20% or something. Put it up. It's got to be more than that. More. So they even dictate like what the final price is going to be of the product.
Just to say where I'm coming from, as someone who deals with licenses and creators for anime and video games, mostly video games, but among other things, I deal with stuff like that from many quarters. It's not a good thing. I don't condone it, but it's far from unusual, is all I'm saying. That's why I'm saying I'm used to businesses operating like that. So when I hear stuff like that, I'm kind of like, meh, you know, that, especially a company as small as Big West that's mostly advertising, they don't really have any IP other than Macross. And at the moment, they're really trying to, you know, they know they've got a golden egg since the Frontier boom. So I would expect all licensing costs have gone up. But to add to your point, Adrian, the big thing with licenses and Arcadia is, once they became legally a brand new entity, as we've discussed before in this podcast, they bumped themselves down to the bottom of the licensing ladder. They now have lower priority than everyone. At this point in time, probably Evolution Toys is higher on that ladder than they are. It's like, okay, maybe I'm overstating that, but they have to renegotiate every single license. This isn't just like, well, why haven't they gone back and done Valk ABC that they did as Yamato Toys, because they don't have those licenses anymore. That doesn't mean they're in danger of not getting them again, or that they are guaranteed to get them again. It's an entire negotiating process, which again, you've got time, you've got the salaries of the people involved, and it's a very consuming process. So They may come up with something completely new, or they may go for licenses they previously had. And you know, for example, the VF4. I want that reissue. That's an amazing piece of technology of engineering. Arcadia has never made a VF4.
Yeah.
They have to again negotiate for that from scratch. But Renato, did you have any final thoughts?
No, I think that's it.
Are you getting a Zero S?
Everyone's doomsaying. I'm not getting a Zero S just because I don't like it.
Oh.
I mean, I don't like the design originally.
Okay.
But I will say this. I mean, you were talking about, Adrian, you were talking about the questionnaires earlier. Yeah. If you remember, the old Yamato products all used to come with questionnaires. And I've actually mentioned this in the podcast before, too, that I used to write down on the questionnaire in the space, what do you want us to make? And I wrote down really, really way out there stuff at the time. You know, before Macross Frontier, I wrote down Koenig Monster, please. You know, thinking that never in a million years they're going to make, and they made it, right? So they are reading that stuff. And for the longest time, I put down VF0D. And then they finally made it, but it was over the 30,000 yen limit. And I said, you know, I don't want it that bad. I may have written it down for many, many years, but even then, 30 is such a milestone that I feel like it better be really, really good. I don't know. I just don't see it. So
I just that's me. I just remember going back 12 years, 15 years when. You know, people were paying. Not everyone, not like the amount of collectors were paying, but when you couldn't get this kind of stuff, and people were buying those really expensive resin kits, the transformable ones, the Studio Half-Life stuff, paying like $600, $700.
Yeah, and those things wouldn't stay together.
Yeah, and you had to build them. You had to know how to do resin kits. And okay, of course, those were in very small numbers, but people would buy them. Or non-transformable resin kits, you know, the Yellow Submarine Macross kits. Those were like 2.5 mon, 3 mon, depending on you get cruiser or battle mode.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing was, even if you didn't build them, you wish you had the skills to build them. You wish you had the money just to own it and have it in the box to say that you're a big fan and have it. Now, everything transforms, everything comes painted, and the price is almost the same. Mm. But everyone's complaining. Mm. Not everyone. I wouldn't even say it's the majority. I think it's just the vocal hardcore collectors that run a blog and have a decent collection and are no longer enjoying it. They're enjoying the clicks on their blog.
Hmm.
You know, they're probably bitching more for the sake of people commenting on the subject opposed to forgiving the manufacturer for, oh, this is a little thing, but hey, this whole thing overall is great.
Hmm.
Like, but that doesn't generate clicks. You know, you want everyone, yeah, you're right, blah, 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 this, this, and that. That's just how it goes.
Yeah. I don't know. I probably will get the VF0D eventually. But it will be a while.
I would like it. It's a really nice looking Valk. But for me, the S comes first in all things.
Why? Because of Roy Foker?
Foy Foker?
Foy?
Foy Foker?
Foy is my favorite character.
My favorite character. Foy it.
Well.
Foy Foker?
I think to wrap this up then, I've seen a bunch of people saying, like, well, looking at this and how much. The high percentage of scrap. And the overhead costs, their margins, despite the prices, must be thin. You know, it almost seems like the company's future is not guaranteed. Like, they could go under at any time.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, guess what? It's been that way for 10 or 15 years now. This is how it's always been. Yeah. You've just never seen it. They've pulled the curtain back. This has always been almost a fly-by-night operation because they're making an expensive product for a very niche and fickle market. If someone, for example, if they were to have 200 people write down, we want a VF0D on those forms, and then not buy that product, Guess what? The company sunk.
I knew Renato. You were talking about me when you said fickle. All right, I'll buy it. But I know they sell it there at the anime shop.
That's how little it would take, right? Is my point.
Yes, you're right.
So, yes, the company could go under at any time. So as we always say, you know, it's a matter of supporting it, as with the Blu-ray, expensive Blu-ray releases, as with anything else. It's a niche.
Yes.
Now, if you can't afford to, and you legitimately can't, that's fine. No one's dragging you to a store and saying, buy this $350 toy.
Yes, because they're not out in stores.
Exactly. They're dragging you to the computer.
Yeah.
But, you know, at least if you can't afford it, that's fine. I normally can't afford these things. I know most people... I know very few Japanese fans who actually buy Arcadia Box.
Well, that's another thing. I mean, like...
The space. No one has space, let alone... I mean, average Japanese salaries are very low. But this is a whole other topic. Most hardcore fans I know outside of Japan have a lot more disposable income for the hobby.
What? I was just thinking, if Arcadia was the size of Bandai, they'd be going through exactly what Bandai is going through, which is exactly what the current collector is going through. They would be producing high-end VF1s or Frontier Valkyries, and they would go for pre-order. They'd all get sold out, and they'd all go up on eBay for like twice the price.
Yeah, you're right.
Just like all the Bandai Valkyries that sell out instantly.
Yeah, that's why I don't buy any more Bandai stuff.
So
can't get it.
And that only happens because of the legal problems, because people are living here or have connections, making sure they're getting all the stock and profiting on eBay, which causes the whole Bandai problem, and everyone bitches about that, and rightfully so. But if Arcadia was Bandai, or was an exact, like, the same size competitor, and producing those numbers, and the demand was there, they'd still have a problem.
At least this way, the prices may be high, but at least the money's going back to the creators of the product, not to a scalper, I guess.
Because, you know, these scalpers aren't run off. They were doing it for the 4G when it was web exclusive only, made to order. They did do that. Chronicles, they did that. And for some people, that backfired. Me. And with the 148 TV Max, that backfired. The 4G was, you know, their last web exclusive. And look how high that went up. Because people ordered it, but it wasn't a 1S or a VF1. So it wasn't like every fan had to buy it. Only Flashback fans bought it. Or people that played the game or liked that design. And so there's not that many that were made.
Yeah.
So.
All right, so it'll be interesting to see what the Zero S is like and whether much of this feedback from the D goes into fixing issues with it, potential issues with it, but we will see come the end of the year, I guess. Anyways, I think that's about enough for one episode. As always, you can find us on the Macross World forums, on any of several Facebook groups. You can get in touch with us via the forums, or if you don't want to get into that hive of scum and villainy, you can contact us via email at speakerpod@gmail.com. And we are always happy to receive feedback, comments, suggestions. What do you guys want to know about Macross? Let us know, and we'll do our best to look into it. But until next episode, then, this is the Speaker Podcast, folding out.
Mr. Mgay. Mgay. How's the quality on this, Mr. K? Mgay.
Mgay. It's bad. It's very bad.
Colors off. It's blue. It's gray.
Hey, these are kitty lacquers of shit.
You can't say shit. Okay.
Don't say shit. Okay. Put a lot of work in this. Okay. We never get this inside.